be seated. Good morning. There will be no classes with us today because of the snow, I assume. I'll call our first case for the February calendar, 08AP2765CR, State v. David D. Funk. Arguing on the behalf of the State is Marguerite M. Mueller.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Mueller, representing the petitioner, State of Wisconsin. This matter is here on the State's petition to review a decision of the Court of Appeals, which affirmed an order entered by the Juneau County Circuit Court awarding David Funk a new trial on two counts of first-degree sexual assault of a child. The trial court found, after trial, that a 20-year-old juror, Tanya G., had incorrectly answered a material question during voir dire, and that she was both objectively and subjectively biased against Funk. Although the defense motion seeking a new trial had focused on her non-response to a statement the trial court made about the fact that the jury was going to be asked whether any juror or a sibling or a neighbor had been the victim of a sexual assault, that was not the question on which the trial court focused in finding that Tanya G. had failed to answer a material question. The question the court focused on was whether any juror had testified as a witness in a criminal case. And she did not raise her hand when one of the attorneys posed that question to the panel.
Counsel, was it criminal or civil case, or doesn't that matter?
Actually, both questions were asked. I believe it was defense counsel who asked in succession, anyone ever go to court to testify in a civil case? Anyone ever go to court to testify in a criminal case? So both of those questions were posed.
And what should have her answers been to those questions?
Well, she had never gone to court to testify in a civil case, but she had testified at a preliminary hearing in a case 3 years before Funk's trial where she was the victim of a sexual assault. We don't know, however, why she didn't raise her hand, because that question was never asked of her at the evidentiary hearing, even though prior to that hearing, defense counsel had a copy of the preliminary hearing transcript in State versus Cervantes. So defense counsel knew that she had testified as a witness in a criminal case, but nobody asked her why she didn't raise her hand. Instead, the focus at the hearing was on whether or not the panel had ever even been asked.
Counsel, why is that significant that no one ever asked her at the post-trial hearing why she did not raise her hand in response to the question about prior testimony?
I think it's significant for two reasons. The main reason is that under State versus Weiss, you first have to show that a juror failed to respond either fully or just not at all to a material question. And then you have to show that under the circumstances, it is more probable than not that the juror was biased against the defendant. And this court has said that it's not simply a matter of giving a false answer. You have to look at the reason. Was it inadvertent? Was it intentional deceit? Was the juror biased against the defendant, or was there some other reason? And because Tanya was never asked, why didn't you raise your hand, neither the trial court nor the Court of Appeals, nor this court really knows why. It's possible that she, as the State posited in its brief, misunderstood that there was not a difference between being a victim and a witness. And she could have thought, I wasn't a witness. I didn't watch myself being sexually assaulted. I was the victim in that case. It could have been something as simple as she spaced out and wasn't paying attention when that question was posed to the panel, because there were a lot of questions, some of them in fairly rapid-fire succession, being posed to the panel as a whole. So I think it's important because the defendant has the burden on both prongs of the test of State versus Weiss, and I don't see how any court could find whether her failure to respond to the question the trial court found material was inadvertent versus whether it was intentionally kept from.
Counsel, how would you like us to analyze this? Subjective bias, objective bias, both? And if so, what do you think our analysis should be and what should the standard of review be?
Well, I think the easiest way the court could dispose of the case, but I would doubt that it would want to do this because this court doesn't take review of cases for something this simple, could simply be to find that the trial court misused its discretion in relying on this other question as the basis for the defense motion. Because really the trial court was taking almost a quasi-adversarial position here. The prosecutor in the trial court and defense counsel pretty much argued at the evidentiary hearing on whether the question about having been a victim of sexual assault was ever really asked. And the prosecutor kept saying, Judge, that question wasn't really asked. You simply made this statement kind of foreshadowing that this is what you're going to be asked. And that was really the focus. And then eventually when the trial court gave its oral decision, which was, I think, 10 days after the evidentiary hearing, the trial court had to admit, yes, the prosecutor was right all along. I found after a careful review that nobody had ever asked that specific question. But then the trial court went further and looked at the whole transcript and zeroed in on another question. Did anybody ever go to court and testify as a witness in a criminal case? And said, she failed to answer that, that's a material question, and then went to the second prong of Weiss. So in the first instance, this court could very narrowly decide the case and say, trial judge should not have done this because it really robbed the state of the opportunity to ask Tanya G. about her non-response to that question.
That's a broad holding that says any time you are going to strike down a juror, in effect, that the judge cannot rely on a question that was not posed at the Mockner hearing or the subsequent post-conviction hearing.
Well, I think that the judge had...
Did I state your position correctly?
Where it's like this, where it was not even the subject of questioning, yes.
Right.
Because it makes it impossible to satisfy the Weiss test, which is you really have to show that the reason for the non-response was something that was rooted in not just dishonesty, but bias or prejudice against the defendant. Because the bottom line here is, did Mr. Funk get a new trial? Not whether did a juror tell a lie or make a misrepresentation. So it's really a two-part inquiry.
It's been a while since I've read the Weiss case. If I recall, it's a first-degree murder case. The Court of Appeals reversed the conviction in the interest of justice. Is that the right case I'm thinking of in the Weiss case?
I think that's correct. It was out of Dane County, and there were a lot of issues
wrote the opinion, yeah.
in the case. But I think eventually it was in the interest of justice.
Mm-hmm. So...
But that was one of the issues had to do with so it wasn't reversed because of a juror there. But that is where the test that we use for juror misconduct comes from.
Counsel, did you have a chance to answer my question?
I wasn't all the way through. So going on to if your finding is that the trial court was well within its rights to look at this other question, then the state's position is that the trial court made a clearly erroneous factual finding when it determined that Tanya G. was subjectively biased against Funk. And subjective bias, as this court stated in State versus Lindell, is normally demonstrated by a juror's words and demeanor during voir dire. Now, obviously, here we don't have anything from Tanya G. during voir dire because she never raised her hand to, I think, any question that was asked, except for maybe the question about whether anyone had any medical training, because she was a certified nursing assistant. So we have to focus on her words and demeanor at the evidentiary hearing. Well, if you look at her words, there was certainly nothing in anything she said when the trial court questioned her to suggest at all that she was biased against David Funk. She was very steadfast in saying that she harbored no ill will towards him, that she never even thought about her experiences as a child subjected to sexual assault, either during the testimony or during the jury deliberations, and that she felt she was not even uncomfortable listening to the evidence come in about this 10-year-old girl being sexually assaulted. So you cannot say there was anything in the words she spoke. Now, obviously, the court sitting there as the fact finder can look at a juror's demeanor. But there's no indication here that Judge Romer really was looking at her demeanor. Judge Romer didn't say anything like, well, she couldn't look me in the eye when she gave these answers, or her voice changed, or she got red in the face, or I just didn't think she was telling the truth. To the contrary, Judge Romer said, I'm not calling her a liar, and it's not that I'm not taking you at face value. That's exactly what he said to Tanya G. His problem was he could not understand how somebody with the juror's background could not have been biased. In other words, he was substituting his feelings for how he thought a sexual assault victim should react to this kind of experience when he came to the conclusion that she had to be subjectively biased against Funk. And this court is well aware from all of the sexual assault cases that come before it that there is a wide range of reactive behavior on the part of sexual assault victims. Not every sexual assault victim doesn't want to testify and cowers in a corner. Some victims want to get the person who assaulted them. Other sexual assault victims want to stay as far away from the judicial process as they possibly can. And with respect to how this kind of experience had an impact on Tanya G, she was obviously a very resilient young woman. The bus driver assaults, as they were called, occurred 10 years before the time that she was a juror at Funk's trial. And 10 years is really a pretty long time in the life of somebody who's only 20 years old when they sat as a juror. And with respect to the sexual assault that occurred when she was 17, that situation was very far removed from the circumstances surrounding these charges. She was sexually assaulted at a party where alcohol was being consumed, and she was pretty much an adult at the time that happened. So the trial court really was not making, in the state's view, a credibility determination saying, I don't believe her. The trial court was saying, I just don't get it. I cannot wrap my head around how somebody with this background couldn't be thinking about these assaults. And that is why the state believes that even though the burden to overcome a factual finding by the trial court is pretty significant, the state believes it has met that burden in this particular case. And the dissenting judge on the Court of Appeals felt likewise. There was a 2-to-1 split in the Court of Appeals.
Counsel, since the second prong of the Weiss test was not satisfied because nobody asked her the question, couldn't we just remand this case to the circuit court for purposes of taking evidence in that regard?
Well, I think you certainly have that within your power, but the state, frankly, does not believe it would be a very effective remand because, as a practical matter, I really could not see how somebody who sat as a juror 3 years earlier would really have a good memory about what questions were asked at voir dire and why she did not raise her hand in response. I mean, it's possible, but I would really question what value that would have. And in addition, I think Funk had his opportunity at the evidentiary hearing that was held back in August of 2008. He had his opportunity to look at the voir dire. The voir dire was only maybe 60 pages long, and he had before him the information that Tanya G had been a witness at a preliminary hearing, but he didn't do his homework and look at it to see whether or not she had raised her hand in response to that question. So
your position is that the defense did not meet its burden at the post-conviction hearing. Is that correct?
I think that will be the would be the outcome that it could not because of the passage of time, that it's just not going to be very useful. I don't think I can say as a matter 100% that it couldn't. Maybe Tanya G will come up with something, but I really at this point don't feel that a 3-year passage of time makes it very realistic to think that she's going to have any memory of this question being asked. And I think it's also, it should have been done at the time in 2008 when they had the evidentiary hearing. It was the defense's burden, and defense counsel gave the trial court a series of questions for the court to ask. And obviously that was not one of the questions that was on the list because nobody ever focused on that.
Let me ask you another question. One of the portions of the Weiss test is failure to respond to a material question. Is there any dispute that the question having to do with being a witness in a criminal case or a civil case was a material question?
There hasn't been any dispute, but that brings up a very good point. I was trying to decide how the term material question has been defined in the case law, and I did not find any cases that really addressed this. And it seems that a lot of times it's really the answer to a question that determines whether or not it is material. So I think one possible working definition, and the word material I think is a little bit kind of a misnomer. It's more a question the answer to which would be consequential to one of the issues in the case. Because certainly you could have the question, did you ever testify as a witness in a criminal case, being asked in a civil case, and really it's kind of like what difference would it make if that doesn't have any relevance at all to the issues. Another example would be at the beginning of a voir dire, a trial judge often has each panelist go around and give very basic information about himself or herself, including what do you like to do in your spare time? And if a juror says, well, I like to listen to opera, and it's really a lie. It's like if the person was trying to make themselves seem more elitist, whatever, cultured. And so what? So the person did lie, but that's not a material question because nobody really cares whether the juror in his or her spare time listens to opera. On the other hand, if the juror's real hobby was dabbling in forensic evidence and the criminal case before them had a lot to do with blood spatter evidence, then failing to divulge that, the answer to that question would be material. So I think it's difficult to say in a vacuum, is the particular question material? So here I think the question, did anyone ever go to court to testify as a witness in a criminal case, would be material by virtue of the answer it would spawn. But the question about the civil case really was not material, and there's really not a dispute. She did not testify as a witness in the lawsuit that involved the school district and the bus driver.
But really, the answer to that question, have any of you ever testified in a criminal proceeding, only becomes material based on several subsequent questions.
That's correct.
Looking at it neutrally, in isolation, the answer to the question, have any of you ever testified in a criminal proceeding, yes or no, makes no difference. It is only the subsequent questions, well, was that a case in which you were the complaining witness? What kind of case was it? So does that relate to your argument at all?
Well, I have not argued that this question was not material, but I think, again, it makes it interesting to see how you define a material question, because the only way I could come up with a workable definition is by virtue of would the question, the answer to which, be consequential? And here, her answer would have been consequential, but I could not find this materiality.
Her answer to that particular question would not have been consequential. It would have been a yes or no. I don't see how that.
I see what you're saying. The bald answer, yes or no, would not have been. It's when you know what it would have prompted the parties to then ask.
It's consequential because there would have been further questioning.
Correct.
On this issue. Okay.
Correct.
Counsel? You discussed Weiss. As I said, I think that's the first-degree murder case. But about 9 or 10 years after Weiss, this court issued what we considered the piece de resistance of juror bias cases. And that was the Foucher case.
By Justice Steinmetz.
By Justice Steinmetz, that's right. And so it sets up, and this court attempted in that case to bring together our many and varied cases on juror bias. And so this was it. And we set up a construct. You had objective bias, statutory bias, and subjective bias. And in statutory bias is self-explained, it's, you know, statutory reason. Then you had defined what we meant by objective bias. And essentially it was, and is, under the facts and circumstances, the judge must determine whether a reasonable person in the juror's shoes could remain unbiased. That's from paragraph 29 of Foucher. So it's a reasonable person standard. Then on review, Foucher said, we look to see whether a reasonable judge could have reasonably concluded that the reasonableness of the juror. You know, they got a lot of reasonableness in there. But that was the standard of review, and that was the question, of course, that Justice Ziegler initially touched upon. So that's the standard of review for objective bias. Now, subjective bias is different, and that was also set forth in the Foucher case. And in subjective bias, you look at the demeanor and the words of the prospective juror. And that's the test that's set out, again, in Foucher and in paragraph 27. And it turns on his or her responses on voir dire and a circuit court's assessment of the individual's honesty and credibility. So those are the two tests. And we will the standard of review is clearly erroneous. We'll uphold the circuit court's determination on subjective bias unless its determination is clearly erroneous. So different tests. It sounds, which one is your stronger argument? That the court was wrong in its subjective determination or its objective determination?
I think it's hard to predict how this court would view it. I personally think it's more difficult to overcome a finding on subjective bias, because in order to do so, you have to agree with the state's argument that Judge Romer was not really making a credibility determination, but he was making a blanket judgment on how victims of sexual assault should feel as a result of that prior experience and whether they could keep an open mind. Objective bias is a question of law. And even though this court has, in several cases, I think maybe including Foucher, indicated that you're still going to accord some deference to the circuit court's finding on objective bias just because that finding is so closely intertwined with the factual findings, I don't think this case is an appropriate one to accord that deference. And one of the main reasons is that the primary rationale, and I think this is from State versus Lindell, that you accord that deference to a circuit court is that going forward at the time of voir dire, it's believed that the trial court is in a more advantageous position than the juror would be to know what the evidence is going to be at trial and to kind of know better than the juror himself or herself knows as to whether or not it's likely to have an impact during the testimony or the deliberations. We don't have that situation here. Here, Tanya G., at the time of the post-trial evidentiary hearing, was better positioned than Judge Romer to say in hindsight whether she had been affected during her testimony by her experience as a sexual assault victim. She knew what evidence had come in. That was a done deal. She also knew whether that had impacted her attitude during jury...
Please finish your sentence.
During jury deliberation. So I don't think that the deference that is normally accorded a trial court's finding on objective bias really applies here.
It's not clear to me how your Weiss argument of making sure you get the right question in comports with the standard set forth in Foucher 9 or 10 years later. I'm not sure that in determining whether under the facts and circumstances circuit court looks to see under the Foucher test, the objective test, whether a reasonable person in the juror's shoes could remain unbiased, I'm not sure that that test requires anything other than the court to take a look under the facts and circumstances. Could you respond to that?
Well, I think one thing the court has to keep in mind is that Foucher and a lot of those cases from around that era were all decided in the context of the issue being brought up during the actual voir dire, where there was a reason that a juror was being challenged, and my time is up, but if it's all right, I'll just finish my...
You may finish your thought,
Thank
counsel.
You, Your Honor. Those cases really were sort of front-end cases, and Weiss is different because in Weiss, that's a situation where after the fact, it is determined that a juror failed to respond either fully or accurately to a material question. And so in that situation, the defendant has a bigger burden to bear because he has to make, he has to establish both prongs of the test, showing first that there was this wrong answer to a material question, and second, under the circumstances, it is more likely than not that this juror was biased against him. And I think that's a different standard than the front-end cases like Foucher. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Is it Chater?
Chater.
Michelle Ann Chater, representing David Defunk. Counsel?
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel? This is the first time I've been able to argue that I don't think a trial court judge screwed up. It's kind of unusual.
Well, congratulations, counsel. May we be the first.
I think that the record demonstrates clearly that Judge Romer was not guilty of abuse of discretion and was not clearly erroneous in his finding that juror Tanya G. was both subjectively biased and objectively biased. The record that was produced as a result of the hearing held on the defense motion for a new trial shows several instances in which juror Tanya G. was untruthful and lacking in credibility. Juror Tanya G. testified under oath at first that she did not even think about the prior child sexual assault to which she and her two younger sisters had been subjected. Then, in direct conflict with that, juror Tanya G. testifies that, in fact, she chose intentionally not to reveal that evidence, that she went through that thought process not to reveal that evidence because she was worried about a civil judgment that may flow from a civil lawsuit that had been settled just months before she was serving on this jury, something to the tune of a $5,000 penalty if she chose to disclose that to anybody. Those two pieces of testimony by her are inherently contradictory. They cannot both be true. Either she didn't think of it at the time of voir dire, or she did think of it and chose deliberately, even though she was under oath, not to reveal it. Similarly, when Tanya G. testified about the sexual assault to which she had been subject only 3 years before sitting on this jury, she provided information that is just patently unbelievable. She testified that she didn't know her assailant. And in fact, the record on appeal demonstrates that this was somebody that she had known for years because he'd been dating her best friend for years. She referred to him throughout the preliminary hearing, not by the defendant or he or him, but by Julian. This was somebody she knew. She'd been to his home. She knew where his bedroom was. All of that is clear from her testimony at the preliminary hearing. And yet she repeatedly, when she was asked specific questions by Judge Romer, tried to pass this off as things that she didn't recall, didn't remember. And it's just patently not believable.
Counsel?
Yes.
May I ask you, I'm stepping back to be a trial court judge now.
Mm-hmm.
You're back and you're conducting voir dire. You have somebody back in chambers. They explain to you. Just assume Tanya G. told you all this information back in chambers.
Yes.
Would you then move the trial court to strike her for cause on the basis that she is both subjectively and objectively biased? And should the court always strike a victim of sexual assault on the basis that they must be subjectively and objectively biased because they have that experience?
To answer your second question first, my answer is absolutely not. And in fact, the last child sexual assault case that I tried, I kept a victim on for very good reasons, because I think that they are not always biased. To answer your first question...
Well, let me ask you this,
yes,
then, just to follow up on that. How did the defense meet their burden to show that she was biased here? They might have shown that she failed to answer a question, either... We don't know if it's purposeful, she spaced out, if there was, she really didn't understand it. I mean, you look at Delgado and we had the answers. We knew why that witness thought, oh, well, when they referred to that, I didn't think that meant what my situation was. And therefore, the court knew why the person didn't answer and then could go on to make the findings as to whether that person was biased or not. Here we're missing that link. We're missing that piece as to why didn't she answer? We don't know. So how can we assume? And if we make those assumptions, should we make them in every case?
I don't think that we are missing that piece, because quite frankly, if we're going to argue that we're missing that piece, then the only way that that piece can be fit into the puzzle by the defendant is for the witness or the juror to admit, you're right, I'm biased, and here's why. And obviously, we're not going to get that in every case. As I put in my brief, we're not going to get that great Perry Mason moment where the witness confesses.
So don't you need to ask the person, though, so the judge can observe their demeanor, how they answer, what's going on, whether there really was a reason? I mean, if you look at the Delgado case, it's somewhat instructive on why that's so important to know, why the person didn't answer the question. Here, no one said, you know, why didn't you say you testified? I mean, a layperson may not understand testimony in a criminal proceeding to be testimony at a preliminary hearing. They may think that only means at trial. I don't know what she was thinking, nor do you. So how do we know? How do we know?
I think, Your Honor, and this is somewhat difficult because I'm speaking for Judge Romer, but I'm going to take Judge Romer's words at face value. And he says on page 62, line 17 of Record 45, which is the hearing in which they're questioning juror Tanya G, he says at the end, quote, this is not going to be that difficult for the court to render a decision, close quote. I think because he just doesn't believe what she has said.
But he didn't say that. If you really want to take his words,
I understand
his words, he didn't say that. In fact, he said the opposite.
And actually, he has a throwaway line, what I would characterize as a throwaway line, in his decision hearing 10 days later, where he says, now, I'm not calling Tanya G a liar. And I characterize that the same way that the majority opinion characterized that in the Court of Appeals, which is that it's simply a nice guy not calling somebody a liar. But he goes on to say several other things that I think lead you to have to conclude that he doesn't believe her. And quite to get back to what you had asked me before, I do think Tanya G answered the questions about why she lied, why she wouldn't reveal that information. She says, I don't reveal it ever again. I could tell you what happened. She's just not going to talk about it. And I think, and again, I'm having to put myself in the position of the trial court, and we're having to put ourselves back there in voir dire and at the time of the hearing on the motion, and which is one of the difficult things about this case. The record, there aren't magic words. The record is somewhat unclear. But I think that everyone had just gotten to the point where they were done with her. She wasn't telling the truth. She wasn't answering questions. And you get to a point where you just... No more questions for this witness.
So if she would have done that back in chambers, do you think the court would need to move, strike her for cause?
I'm not sure. And in part, and in large part, it's because I wasn't there. And when we talk about assessing subjective bias, we have to give great deference to the folks that were, the folks that observed her demeanor, how she answered those questions. How did she come across when she says, I don't reveal it ever again? Was that an extremely aggressive statement such that you could conclude that there was no way she was going to answer these questions? I don't know. So I can't answer that question because I wasn't in that room. Is it possible I may have asked the court to strike her for either subjective or objective bias had I been trial court counsel and had she honestly answered the questions? Yes, it is possible. I can certainly tell you this. I would have struck her for cause.
You would have exercised a strike.
Yeah.
Because essentially now it's the court exercising, you know, saying for cause you are both subjectively and objectively biased. You could not sit as a juror on this case. And you now, after the fact, need to be stricken from this panel. And so I'm wondering when it changes, how much more we know now and what really is the linchpin other than, I mean, she either was untruthful purposely or maybe not purposely, but we don't know that. And so I'm trying to figure out when it changed from whether there's a court obligation to strike someone for cause, because this is so clear during voir dire, or if it changes after the fact. And it seems like the only thing that really changed after the fact was the determination that she, for some reason unknown, failed to answer a question.
I think the court is somewhat mischaracterizing things. We don't have to. I mean, we have to remember the standard of review here, which is whether Judge Romer was clearly erroneous in what he did.
If it's subjective.
That is correct.
And if it's objective, if then what is it?
I'm sorry. If it's objective, according to Fauscher, it's reversed only if, as a matter of law, a reasonable judge could not have reached such a conclusion. That's our standard. So we're not putting ourselves back there that day because we just can't. So to some extent, I can't answer those questions because it's very speculative. But when we're talking about the standard of review and the record that we have here, I think based on this record, there is no reason to overturn the decision of the Court of Appeals and the decision of Judge Romer. Judge Romer did not reach his decision lightly. If you remember what he has to say in the decision hearing after he orders a new trial for Mr. Funk, he's flat out angry. He talks about the waste of the cost to the county, the fact that the victims have to testify again. He is angry that he felt that he was dragged to reach that conclusion. This was not something he did lightly. And he clearly articulated the law properly. He understood the way in which he was supposed to apply the test here in Fauscher. He understood what subjective bias was. He understood what objective bias was. He properly articulated that. I think the only way that you can conclude that he would reach the decision that he did is if he made a credibility determination on Tanya G's testimony. And granted, he didn't provide us magic words on that, and that is unfortunate. But the fact that we have an imperfect record, perhaps, in his decision hearing is not enough to find that Judge Romer in this case was either clearly erroneous or that, as a matter of law, a reasonable judge could not have reached such a conclusion.
When do we look at the demeanor of the juror?
We can't look at the demeanor of the juror, unfortunately, but the demeanor of the juror, according to Fauscher, is one of the things that must be assessed when the court is making a determination as to subjective bias. And clearly the Fauscher court states that the court assessing the juror's words and demeanor, the juror's state of mind, and making determinations as to their honesty and credibility is an important part in determining whether subjective bias is present.
Is that during voir dire, or is that after post-conviction, or both?
I think it's both, Your Honor. Ideally, it occurs during voir dire, and ideally, had Tanya G. answered these questions honestly, then it would have happened then. Because she chose not to do that, then it had to have happened in the hearing that was held pursuant to the defense motion for a new trial. And if I may, since that has come up, I believe the state is mischaracterizing the narrowness of the defendant's motion for a new trial. If you look at the defendant's motion for a new trial, it does not specifically reference any question that they felt was answered untruthfully. It refers to questions. And in fact, as the Court of Appeals decision notes, the state's reading of the defendant's motion is unnecessarily narrow.
Well, but during the questioning of the juror and during the whole discussion on the post-conviction motion, what was the focus? The state says the focus was on the failure to answer which question? Ever a witness in a criminal proceeding? Was that the focus?
I believe initially, Your Honor, that the focus was why did Tanya G. not raise her hand when the topic of whether you or anyone in your family has ever been a victim of sexual assault was addressed.
Okay, well, let's talk about the topic. Mm-hmm. Use the word topic very carefully rather than question, right?
I do.
And tell us why.
I do that because I would agree that technically Judge Romer did not ask that question. But I also believe that if you look at the voir dire record as a whole, that the parties believed that that matter had been addressed because neither of them had asked the question. And several jurors raised their hands and either went into chambers or in front of the panel, and it's unclear at times when they're in chambers and when they're not, provided that information. And
When was that? When the judge made the statement about experiences with sexual assault?
It's a little bit after that.
Okay.
But it comes up from several people, and they see people going into chambers, people are raising their hands, and they get that information from several people. And in fact, one of the things that Judge Romer is uncomfortable with in the motion hearing where Tanya G is testifying, he says he's thinking about what happened and all these people that had responded. And in fact, he says, so many people raised their hands and provided that information, I find it hard to believe that a reasonable person who was present then and saw what was going on and saw the information that was being provided wouldn't have thought they should disclose.
Well, that's one of the tests under Wise. Did the question ask sufficiently inquire into the subject matter to be disclosed? And we've got a problem here that it wasn't a question, but a comment.
Correct.
And the second part of Wise, and I'm on page 769, were the responses of other jurors to the same question sufficient to put a reasonable person on notice that an answer was required? And that's your point. If the answer to that would be for you, yes.
I believe so. And again, I wasn't there, but it certainly seems as though just the sheer number of people that provided that information, that everybody else who had been a prior victim or had known somebody that was a prior victim of sexual assault raised their hand.
But did he rely on that in his ultimate decision?
Did Judge Romer rely on that in his ultimate decision to grant a new trial? I don't believe necessarily that he did. I think...
And that's what the state's point is, heard it.
It is.
And you answer that?
I would note as well that at the time that the defendant filed the motion for a new trial, I don't believe, or it appears from the record, that no one knew that Tanya G. had been involved in the sexual assault when she was a 17-year-old. Because it's referenced in the transcript of the motion hearing that information had just been recently provided to counsel. And I don't know how it came up. I don't know who found it out. I'm not sure. But that information appears much more recent to the motion hearing than when the motion was actually filed. So I don't know when it came up. It is also clear in the context of the decision hearing that when the state was made aware of the basis for the court's ruling, that the state did not object. The state was silent. And in fact, the state had at its ready a very kind of lengthy and very coherent response to the basis for the court's granting of the new trial. And in fact, said that they had already been in contact with the AG's office, that they were disagreeing with the court's decision and rationale and why. So it doesn't appear from that record as though the state was nearly as sandbagged as they're now claiming that they were on appeal. Mr. Southworth had a response available. He never objected to the court's basing its decision on that factor by saying, I didn't get a chance to address this at the hearing or anything like that.
Well, What was his basis of appeal then?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. He appeared ready to proceed on interlocutory appeal on the issue. He never said, I feel like I've been sandbagged, I didn't get to ask the juror any of these questions. Just as Mr. Funk had an opportunity to say certain things at the time of the motion hearing, the State had an opportunity to say certain things at the time of the decision hearing and did not do that.
May silence be viewed as demeanor in context?
Silence may be viewed as demeanor in certain contexts, I believe, yes.
Counsel, in response to the Chief Justice's question about whether or not the trial court relied on the other jurors responded to the question regarding sexual assault. In reading the transcript, I got the impression that it did. The trial court did. So respond to me. Tell me where I'm wrong. On page 4 of the transcript, Petitioner's Appendix 117, the very bottom, the trial court is saying in his decision, 117 at the bottom, with respect to other jurymen who answered question, Mr. Edwards answered his question. So that's one juryman. And it appears, continuing on the next page, I'm going to paraphrase, that he volunteered that he was accused of some sexual assault. So he responded to that. The judge indicated that counsel went on and asked the jury or informed the jury that this case involves allegations of sexual assault, as the judge told you. And based on those allegations, those charges, does anyone here believe they would have a difficult time being fair and impartial, both to the State of Wisconsin and the defendant? And at that point, this is the judge speaking, Ms. Jacks raised her hand, and then they went into chambers. And then later during voir dire, the court asked Mr. Jorgensen if he had any answer, if he would have answered yes to any questions, and he responded and he went into chambers. It's not clear with regard to a couple of them. I'm reading just what's here.
Right.
Finally, the court went into chambers with Ms. Newhausen, and then the court continues on the next page. I recall, and we'll get to that later, Mr. Koch asked, has anyone been a victim other than in sexual assault of a crime? And so all of this is in the context of those those statements made that the case involves sexual assault. The record, as I review it, isn't precise with regard to the court saying, when Ms. Jacks went into chambers, we discussed sexual assault. When Mr. Georgian went into chambers, we discussed sexual assault. When Ms. Newhausen went into the chambers, we discussed sexual assault. But in the context of his comments before, after, and during, always referring to the information that this case is a sexual assault, I think that's a reasonable interpretation. It may not be the only interpretation, but that's the way I interpreted it. You didn't, apparently, because in your response to your question, when the chief asked, did the court rely on, citing Weiss, the responses of other jurors, were they sufficient to put juror in question on notice, you said, no, there wasn't anything in the transcript. So what am I missing or with regard to my read of the transcript? Is it not reasonable?
I think it is reasonable, Your Honor. And perhaps I was answering the question too narrowly. If you look at the judge's written decision as to specifically why in the written decision he makes a finding that a new trial is in order, he refers to that only that one question about having been a prior witness in a criminal case. But you are right in the sense that the Judge Romer is clearly very concerned about the fact that it appears as though I think every other juror who would have had to answer that question, had that question technically been asked, have you or anyone in your family or anyone you know well been a victim of sexual assault, had that technically been asked, that it appears as though everyone who would have had to raise their hand yes to that did at some point in the context of the voir dire. But
at least everybody that we know about.
I'm sorry?
At least everybody that we know about. I mean, we don't know what the history was of all the jurors. Right?
Exactly, which is why I say it appears.
And so, counsel, I guess in terms of this part of the colloquy coming from the bench, so what? Are you asking for an expansion of the first prong of the Weiss opinion, where that a juror's incomplete or incorrect answer to a question asked will now be expanded to an inquiry of a trial court statement of a potential question that may come up? I believe the language that the trial court used was this. Now, one of the questions is going to be, I believe, is, have any one of you been a victim of sexual assault or a brother or sister who's been sexually assaulted, possibly a neighbor of sexual assault? And then the trial court judge goes on, with respect to that question, to be quite frank with you, if somebody asked me, have you ever been a victim of sexual assault, I wouldn't answer it. But you are under oath. Maybe it's a brother or a sister. Maybe it's a neighbor. Or maybe it's yourself. We could go into chambers if you wish to. We certainly don't have to. You need to be honest. You need to answer the question. And what we will do is, to avoid any embarrassment, we can go into chambers. Now, a careful listening to that would not yield a question. Fair enough?
Yes, which is...
And so that brings me to the original question that I started with. Are you seeking an expansion of the first prong of the Weiss opinion?
I am not, which is why I did not argue that in my brief, Your Honor.
So are you arguing it now?
I am not. I'm attempting to respond to Justice Bradley's question.
Right. I just wanted to be very clear on that.
Okay,
point.
And if I may finish answering Justice Bradley's question, I think that it becomes important to look at Judge Romer's concerns about why Tanya G. never raised her hand to that question when it appears as though many other people did, and if not all of them, many did. I think that that factored into his concerns and ultimate finding that juror Tanya G. wasn't credible. Because when she says, this never even occurred to me, I never thought about it, and so forth, in the hearing when she's being questioned by Judge Romer, I believe that is very relevant to her credibility and believing what she said when she says that this didn't occur to her, that she wouldn't have thought to mention it. Other jurors clearly did, for whatever reason, perhaps not asked directly. Other jurors clearly did, and when she testifies under oath, again, at the motion hearing, didn't even pop into my head. I think Judge Romer has a real hard time believing that, as do I, which, as I said in the beginning, I believe drives his decisions and his ultimate holding that juror Tanya G. was not only subjectively biased, but objectively biased. So I think that's where that gets plugged in.
Can I try again to sort this out? If a juror is determined by a judge during voir dire to be subjectively biased, the judge should strike that juror, right?
Correct.
If a juror is determined during voir dire to be objectively biased, the judge should strike that juror, right?
Correct.
Based upon what you knew, what we now know after the fact, without the assumption that she lied, okay? What would the judge's findings here be if all this came out at voir dire to show she was subjectively biased and objectively biased, such that at that stage during voir dire, she would have been removed as a person from the panel?
I want to make sure that I understand your hypothetical, because it is a hypothetical, because she didn't answer the questions at voir dire.
But the point is, we're saying, had we known this, it would have affected and infected the process such that she wouldn't have been a juror. Her staying on as a juror would affected the validity of this case and the fairness of this case. That's what we're saying. And we know based upon case law, it can't just be the fact that you didn't answer a question or that you didn't understand a question. It's got to be more than that. It's got to be that, look at this person. this person is subjectively biased. This person is objectively biased. Such that if we knew this information at the time, the judge would have had to make the findings and take her off the case. Tell me what the judge's findings during voir dire would have been had he known this information then.
I don't know, because I believe that one of the things, the primary thing, that creates a situation in which this particular juror is found to be subjectively and objectively biased is her untruthful testimony at the motion hearing.
That's exactly and what so, I was trying to figure right, out earlier, if the untruthfulness is the key. That's the key to her being an inappropriate juror later, right? It's because she's untruthful. Do we know why, or are we assuming that she's untruthful for bad reasons? Do we know why? Did anyone ask her, why didn't you answer this question? Why didn't you bring this up? Or are we making assumptions? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
As I've stated before, I think that because so many of the answers that she provided in the motion hearing were clearly untruthful, it got to the point where it was ridiculous to continue to ask her questions. And to answer your earlier question, I don't know. If she had truthfully answered those questions of voir dire, I don't know whether she would have been found to be subjectively or objectively biased. I wouldn't have been able to see her. You have to see her demeanor. You have to make those decisions when you're in the midst of voir dire in a trial. I don't know. But I would submit that if she had truthfully answered those questions in voir dire, that would have made her a completely different person, because she chose not to. She chose not to provide that information. And then she also was untruthful in the motion hearing subsequent. So the hypothetical posed by the court is a hypothetical juror that we just don't have here.
Thank you.
Well, if I heard you right, you say she was untruthful because, that is, the judge thought she's untruthful, because she said that she chooses not to reveal these prior issues in her background, her thought process is and that she wouldn't reveal the civil issue because she was afraid of the $5,000 penalty, that she wouldn't reveal the 3-year prior sexual assault because she, I'm going to translate it, doesn't view herself, it doesn't want to view herself as a victim, it's over with, and that's it. Words to that effect. Now, suppose then when you, now, Justice Ziegler has put this now into the voir dire. So the question is, well, what is the question? Is the question, have you or your family any experience with sexual assault? That's the statement translated into a question. Mm-hmm. She would say no on voir dire. She would say no because she's not willing to say yes. Or on voir dire, she'd say yes, but it's irrelevant. I mean, what does she say? I mean, you have to put it back into voir dire to answer Justice Ziegler's question, I think.
If she were going to be truthful, and if I'm out of time, if I may answer.
You may answer.
If she were going to be truthful, she would have to say yes, and I don't know what her subsequent answer would be. I don't think it's relevant. I don't view myself as a victim. I put it behind me. I'm not sure.
Right. But we have to assume she'd say the same thing at voir dire that she said at the motion hearing.
Correct.
To put it in voir dire.
Correct. And she clearly admits in the motion hearing that she had been a prior victim of sexual assault. She acknowledges that status.
And then the judge would have to make a decision whether that is truthful. That is, whether or not she believes that, whether the judge believes she could be unbiased in light of that.
Correct.
Well, the judge wouldn't decide if she's truthful. The judge would make findings of subjective or objective bias such that the judge would be required to remove that juror for cause.
Correct.
Right.
What would that be? I don't believe her. She's lying. Or subjectively, she says she can do it, but because the subjective bias has an objective component. I mean, just if the juror says, I'm not going to be biased, you're not bound by that.
That's correct.
The judge can still say, you don't think you're biased, but any reasonable person in your position would be biased, therefore I find you subjectively biased. There's an objective component in that subjective finding, at least as I read the cases.
I would agree, kind of a reasonable person analysis that goes on.
And then you go to the objective, would a reasonable person in this position reasonably reach a result that's unbiased, or words to that effect?
Correct.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Much of the focus during opposing counsel's argument had to do with the chronology of events during the voir dire in terms of when did other jurors come forward and reveal, primarily in chambers, that they had been the victim
of a... Did anyone testify outside of chambers? Any juror?
I believe that there were one or two jurors, and I don't recall their names right now, who said something about sexual assault in open court. But primarily, it was all done in chambers. And it was not in response to the trial court's initial statement that Justice Gableman read. Nobody raised their hand when the trial court said, I believe one of the questions is going to be whether you or a brother or a sister, and then I think he even said a neighbor, had been the victim of sexual assault. Nobody's hand went up. It was not until about 11 pages later during the voir dire when the trial court asked, based upon these allegations, these charges, does anyone here believe they would have a difficult time being fair and impartial to the state and to the defendant? And that was when a bunch of jurors raised their hands and were taken serially into chambers, and many of them at that point revealed either they or a family member. I think one woman had a grandchild who was then the subject of a criminal case in Florida involving sexual assault. Those revelations were made in chambers by and large. So Tanya G. was not privy to what those jurors were revealing about themselves or their families.
She was just privy to the ones that said something in open court.
That's correct. Those are the only ones. And since nobody else raised their hand when the trial court made that statement, I think it's disingenuous to say that because of the statement, everybody should have known that they were supposed to volunteer this information. The question...
I know nothing more than what's before me in the written page. And on page of the petitioner appendix 118, the judge says, he describes how Mr. Southwick further went on and informed the jury. Now, in this case, as Judge Romer noted, it involves allegations of sexual assault, etc. The judge then, and I'm saying etc., the transcript doesn't say etc. And then the judge says, at this point, Ms. Jacks raised her hand. So it isn't just with regard to what the judge said regarding sexual assault. Apparently, according to Petitioner's Appendix 118, some of that came out after Mr. Southwick's further comments, right?
That's correct. It's correct that it was not the initial remark that prompted these jurors to come forward, but questions about whether they'd have a difficult time being fair and impartial. And I think this goes back to the state's position that Judge Romer was thinking, this woman has to feel the same as all these other jurors. All these other jurors came forward and said that they would have a hard time being fair and impartial. And I don't understand why she didn't do the same thing. And again, I think that's taking an approach of one size fits all. Everybody should have the same kind of reactive behavior or the same kind of feeling that they're not able to go forward and give a defendant a fair trial based on the fact that they have these sexual assaults in their history. So I think, again, these jurors did feel that their prior experience or a family member's prior experience made them unable to be fair and impartial. Juror Tanya G. was questioned at the evidentiary hearing, and she steadfastly said, She did not have a problem with this. And the judge said he was taking her at face value. He wasn't calling her a liar, but he just could not understand that mindset. And I don't think that's a credibility finding. So I think this goes back to the whole idea that the finding of subjective bias was clearly erroneous. And then in terms of objective bias, really this court has said on several occasions that simply having been a victim of sexual assault does not disqualify a person from sitting on a jury, and that this court is loath to disqualify a group of people saying that they are objectively biased. And that really, in essence, I think, is what Judge Romer did here. He was basically saying anybody who was sexually assaulted as a child 10 years earlier and then had another sexual assault 3 years before, that person, no reasonable person in that juror's position could be fair and impartial towards David Funk. And I just think that that is legally erroneous. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mueller. And thank you, Ms. Jader, for your arguments today in yet another juror bias case. And that concludes our argument in 08-AP-2765-CR, State versus David D. Funk. The court will, as soon as counsel's completed, call its second case.